The Broken Clock podcast returns, and I have no idea how this one's going to go because this is something of a dicey issue that most people have never heard of. If you hang around in the hoity-toity thinky-dinky circles that Mouse and I do, you may have heard the term vaccine nationalism. Now, Mouse hadn't until I brought it up, and Mouse went, "What?" And his husband went, "What?" And I'm like, okay, we got to talk about this. It's been in the news in Canada of late because certain do-gooders, shall we say, have insisted that it is morally wrong for Canada to, long story short, essentially use the vaccines that Canada has paid for in advance, in part to help develop the vaccines that are now being distributed to the whole world. It is morally wrong for Canada to take its share that they pre-committed to out of a program called COVAX, which is an entity where other countries buy COVID-19 vaccines in bulk, in particular the AstraZeneca and Sanofi vaccines. I don't believe the Sanofi one's approved yet. But they buy vaccines and then deliver them to poor nations that can't afford them, essentially. These poor nations, couldn't negotiate the contract, so on and so forth. And so these do-gooders insisting that it's morally wrong for Canada to vaccinate its own people at the alleged expense, and I'm couching things very carefully, Mouse. I'm trying to start in a neutral place, but apparently Canada invested $440 million. I will say this is deficit spending, all of it, right? Last September, half of the money was supposed to go to securing up to 15 million doses for Canadians. The other half was to purchase vaccines for 92 developing nations. That includes Afghanistan, Mali, Haiti. I'll pull up the list while we're reading. There's a whole list of them. Brazil, Colombia. I mean, Brazil is in trouble with COVID. I won't deny that. But what we're going to examine today is the logic of insisting that it is morally wrong for a country, with the caveat that the US under Donald Trump didn't even sign into COVAX, and obviously the US economy is much larger than Canada's. But is it morally wrong for Canada to basically abide by the terms of the deal and get the doses that the country was promised under the deal? Why is this bad? Is this some kind of moral reasoning, or is there actually a point to it? Now, Mouse, you are new to this, so I'm going to throw it over to you. What was your reaction when you saw this?
Well, my reaction was, if the people who are complaining about this now, if they found this so objectionable now, why didn't they protest this when the deal was done?
Right, when the contract was initially signed. Mm-hmm. And perhaps they did, I don't know, right? But I find it interesting that the noise is being made now. Now, I've been hearing about vaccine nationalism for a couple of months. To me, it's more applicable to what the European Union is doing, which is the European Union is threatening to not allow the export of vaccine manufactured at, I believe it's Belgium and Germany, but there's contracts. The companies manufacturing the vaccines want to fulfill the contracts, and yet the European Union won't let them because they believe that Europe should be vaccinated first. And this is what I find very strange about what's going on up here in this country, is that the loyal opposition in Canada is blaming the Trudeau government for what Europe's doing in terms of potentially withholding the vaccine. It turns out that's not going to happen. It was a false alarm. But the fact that the European Union has the power to do that, cause for concern. But the loyal opposition is blaming Trudeau for what Europe's doing, but also getting mad at Trudeau because vaccine nationalism. So it's Trudeau's fault that another country is practicing vaccine nationalism, but it's also Trudeau's fault that, are you seeing the logic problem? Like, he's just to blame for everything. Now, okay, this is politics. It doesn't necessarily make sense. But let's break this down. I mean, I guess I should call attention to the obvious moral element, the appeals to emotion, the emotional reasoning here that rich liberals like to go but starving children in Africa in everything. A few years ago, it moved to but starving children in Haiti. And mm-hmm. I mean, this is a powerful emotional appeal, right? This is, Mouse, I know you have strong feelings about altruism, but this yes. is sort of this idea that altruism is good. I know I have a bunch of reasons why I need to turn off my squishy, bleeding heart, liberal inclinations on this one and recognize there are sort of greater first principles at play, one of which is a deal's a deal. Another of which is, you know, there's the threats posed by China and Russia and this sort of, you know, damaging alleged altruism. You think Russia and China aren't going to vaccinate their own people before they distribute the vaccines to other people? Like, give me a break, right? There's a lot of other more complicated things regarding governments and structures of government around the world, but I don't want to get into those yet, Mouse. I want to give you an opportunity to talk about your reactions to this.
Well, it can be pretty much summarized by a deal's a deal. I do not quite understand at which point we're supposed to move the goalposts. I'm still kind of just staggered by oh God, you know the meme, of course. Oh, give me 1 second. I spilled something.
Oh, no. Because I mean, I'm curious about your point of view, because you come from one of these developing countries, right? So it's not the intellectual exercise it is for me. Strangely, Ecuador is not on the list of countries, which I find odd because Brazil is. And I'm pretty sure the GDP of Brazil is much larger than Ecuador. And Ecuador's got a serious COVID problem right now, doesn't it?
Well, it's not as bad as it was.
Okay.
And they're, at least as far as reported outbreaks, it's sort of actually managed to keep in control. They were one of the ones that were hit the worst.
Yeah.
During the pandemic. If you recall, people were being left dead in the streets. It wasn't pretty.
No. And I mean, the thing, unfortunately, about the COVID reporting is that they report number of cases and number of deaths. It's much harder to find per capita case rates and per capita deaths. And that's the number that really matters, right? Because it's all about the percentage of the population affected. The fact that India has a third of the cases that the United States does. What? India is a hugely populous country. Like that. Now, there are reasons for that. Despite India having a population of what is it? It's billions, right? 1.3 something billion.
Let's see, updated.
Something like that. Whereas the US is what, 300 million and change? So the fact that the U.S. has more coronavirus cases than India, yikes. But there's partial explanations for that. Not all of it. Some of it is just a shitty government response. But some of it is the fact that Americans tend to travel more than the average Indian does, because India, even though it's a developing economy, there is still a huge amount of absolute poverty in India. Those people don't take airplanes, right?
Right. And Americans have been notoriously, famously lax as far as it comes to precautions, because of course.
And see, this, I wasn't planning to bring this up yet, but this is one of the things that concerns me about this idea of a need-based approach to COVID vaccination. How do you determine need? In this case, it's very difficult. This idea of vaccine nationalism and the modeling they're using and the logic they're using is based on stuff like polio and HIV/AIDS. Now, obviously, HIV/AIDS is far less transmissible. It's a whole different vector, right? Mm-hmm. And my concern is if they establish a precedent based on need, we get into the issue of some of the problems with stopping places like China and India from polluting and contributing to climate change. They argue, well, you know, the West had decades to pollute. Now it's our turn. I'm concerned that if we create this sort of permanent class of beggar nations, it's going to take away any impetus for these countries actually improving quality of life for their citizens. It's in a way propping up really terrible governments who don't care about their people.
It is one of the long trends in Ecuadorian history is that, so the country, Ecuador, in and of itself, is enormously rich mm-hmm. in natural resources. Ecuador is blessed more than many countries in Latin America. It has excellent soil, incredibly fertile soil. Mm-hmm. It has bananas, it has cocoa, it has shrimp. There's even uranium in the mountains.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
There's oil. Ecuador is the kind of country that you look at all of the resources and go, why the hell is this not like the Switzerland of Latin America?
Right.
And then, of course, you look at the people. You look at the culture, with the political culture, the industrial culture, the culture in general. Mm-hmm. And you go, okay, that's why. You know, you have populism. It's an entrenchedly populist nation. So it's always looking for solutions from the paternalist entities, mm-hmm. be that the government or be that, you know, any foreign institution that would bail out or soften the blow of many of the very ill advised decisions mm-hmm. that the government or the private sector has taken. So as far as beggar nations go, Ecuador is in many ways has been one of them for the longest time. It's always the notion of someone else is going to save us. Someone else is going to help. Mm-hmm. The COVID control that they instituted was, it had to happen because nobody else was going to do it. So, but yes, it's, as someone who grew up in a country where this type of outlook was kind of the de facto background radiation, mm-hmm. I am very, very much opposed to the idea of establishing bigger nations, of establishing a hierarchy of need, because that's the, you know, like you said, who establishes the need? Who is the one who determines what that need is? It's always very subjective.
Right. Because like, apparently in terms of per capita deaths, Belgium is actually the worst country in the world, followed by Slovenia and the UK. Now they're not anywhere near the top of total, like total deaths, right? It's mm-hmm. it's the number of deaths based on how many people they have in the country, right? Well, the UK is near the top. It's number five in terms of total cases. It actually has more deaths than, more deaths than Russia is reporting. Russia. Right? But right. It's number five in total cases. It's number three in deaths per million people. And so this is, okay, when we determine need, is it current active cases? Is it total number of cases? Is it total number of deaths? Is it deaths per, I would claim need should be based on per capita death, right? That then we get into the COVID long haulers and everything like that, but either per capita cases or per capita deaths. However, again, does that benefit places like the US and in fairness, the UK? I mean, the UK really botched its COVID response in the early days with Boris Johnson flirting with herd immunity. Should this be rewarded by going to the front of the line, even if perhaps they didn't secure the contracts that a place like Canada did? Canada went out of its way to make sure its people were taken care of. Why are we rewarding irresponsibility in terms of this needs-based outcome? You know what I'm saying? It doesn't matter how much work you did. It doesn't matter how responsible you are. Oh, you don't have as many cases, so you don't need it as much. That's punishing people. That's punishing countries that handled the pandemic better. Meanwhile, everybody's still in freaking lockdown in province of Ontario because, well, we don't want people to die, right? Now, I mean, the argument, and I'm frustrated with this argument, so maybe you can put into words the objections to it better than me. But the argument for sort of a needs-based distributing to the poor first, because we're not saying, the argument is not that the poor should get some too. Poorer countries should get some too. That was a pre-existing deal, right? Mm-hmm. Like, okay, we're going to buy 30 million doses of vaccine through COVAX. 15 million is going to go to Canada. 15 million is going to go to the rest of the world. That's the existing deal. That's what Canada's already agreed to, right? Right. Which is still pretty altruistic considering it's paid for with money we don't have right now. We're running up debt to do this. Okay. So $220 million was added to Canada's debt that we're going to have to pay off at some point to send COVID vaccine to the developing world. But people now are saying, no, not even that's good enough. You have to send those doses to the developing world first, even though the US didn't even sign on to this agreement. And, you know, them and Europe and everything like that is gobbling up COVID doses as fast as they can get them. Now, I understand the criticism of Europe again, but this idea that there is somehow a greater need because of poverty just doesn't track in terms of where the outbreak is. You know, I've done a lot of research on the failure to eradicate polio in the developing world. And the problem with eradicating polio is not that they don't have the vaccines. They do. They have like an oral drip vaccine that's very easily administered. Mm-hmm. The problem is because of civil strife and factional warfare and sometimes just, you know, the reality that there are no roads, it's difficult to physically get to certain places. The healthcare workers, Doctors Without Borders, et cetera, cannot actually get to the places to administer these vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't change just because the vaccines get shipped over there. You know, if vaccine availability was the only barrier, polio would be eradicated around the world. The polio vaccine's cheap and plentiful, right?
Yeah, it's a matter of infrastructure, really.
Yeah. Like, are they going to go into areas in, say, Venezuela where they're fighting? I mean, India's got serious political problems right now with mm-hmm. the stuff with the farmers, We don't have time to delve too far into that. You know, are we going to factor in politics? Like, yeah, there's income inequality in China. There's certainly income inequality in Russia. You know, is Russia responsible for its citizens, but Brazil's not? How about India? This is getting into a bit of benevolent racism at mm-hmm. this point. You know, Turkey, with all its, you know, authoritarian rule, should they be judged by the same standard as a more democratically run country? You know, there's a lot of factors here that a simple we're rich, they're poor thinking doesn't factor in. And Mouse, maybe I'm wrong about this, but it just seems to me that the core of this thinking, as surfacely altruistic as it is pretty much we're better than these people. Therefore, we have to pity them. That seems, okay, you're laughing. Am I off here?
No, here's the thing. In order for Comtean altruism to be a thing, mm-hmm. and listeners at home, true believers, that was a Stanley reference. this is not a cult. You will notice that I use the words Comtean altruism.
Yes,
because
yes.
We have mentioned this in the past, but if you're just catching on now, if you're just, you know, dropping in to listen now, I draw a distinction between what people call altruism, which is usually just benevolence or kindness or generosity. Mm-hmm. That's the colloquial use of the word, versus the actual meaning of the word as it was coined by French philosopher Auguste Comte, which and his definition of altruism was a complete regard for other people over your own interests. The only moral action, Comte argued, is an action in which you have absolutely no gain and no interest and no investment whatsoever. And for those of you who think I'm going to be strawmanning his philosophical stance, I am not. You can go ahead and research this. But for example, if let's go for a lifeboat scenario, because philosophers love.
Isn't the example he used that if a murderer is trying to kill your wife, you have to let him because you're basically saying her life is worth more than his?
I don't believe that was an actual example that he used, but basically, if, for example, your wife is, we're going for the lifeboat scenario, okay. Because I like making fun of trolley problems and
yes.
things of that sort.
Yes.
Because they're ridiculous.
But yes.
Let's frame it into one of the things that academic philosophers love to use, which is mm-hmm. the trolley problem or similar lifeboat. You have your wife. She is drowning. Now, ideally, you love your wife. Ideally, she's a good person, etc. Right. You know, she's not a mass murdering fuckhead like Eddie Izzard referred to Adolf Hitler.
Yeah.
Peeps to Eddie Izzard. And the next then there's another person who is at an equal distance in the opposite direction, who is drowning. And you know this man to be a criminal, a murderer, potentially a rapist. Now, from the postulations of Comtean altruism, it is a far more virtuous action, a far more moral action for you to help the murderer, the rapist. Why? Because you have a vested interest in your wife's life.
Right.
Therefore, that makes that action already not virtuous, because you're not doing it disinterestedly without regard to your own values and interests. That is Comtean altruism in a nutshell. So, one thing, and it's really, really funny because
to be clear, this means you don't save your wife.
Your wife dies.
So you can save a criminal.
Right.
Right.
Very much so. Or a total stranger. You know, we don't even need to make him a murderer.
Yeah, let's use the total stranger example because that fits better. But yeah, okay. So what
this is Comtean, a total stranger.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Comtean altruism dictates that you must save a total stranger before your loved ones.
Yes, because very much come to militarism regards self-interest, and that extends to basically everything that you see as valuable.
Right.
As not inherently, not moral, period.
Right.
It is not possible for you to perform a moral action that pertains to your self-interests. Of course, right. there is a deep contradiction in this, because if you have no interest in anything, you have no vested interest in anything, you basically have
no morals.
Drive.
Yeah, well, yeah.
No moral and no drive to do anything. But here's the thing. Here is the interesting thing. Just like those philosophers who have been drinking way too much absinthe and who want to make arguments against the existence of reality, using reality as its basis, because mm-hmm. that's all you can do. There, you cannot deny reality using right. anything else but itself. Comte tried to deny the ego and the
Jungian Freudian ego, right?
Well, not just that, but also the notion that that agency and values are dependent upon your core of interests and what you deem to be valuable.
Right, right.
Basically the self. Auguste Comte tried to deny the self, which is kind of funny, because if you have to deny the self, doesn't that mean that you're denying the self of the person for whom you are doing that nice thing?
Well, I have to say that only rich assholes even remotely think this way. If you're listening to this, guys, and it sounds crazy to you, that's because it is. This is what happens when philosophers start getting into this moral reasoning, completely divorced from the potential that it could ever happen to them.
That's why Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius were very disdainful of what they called book and pen, or I guess scroll and pen philosophers, because you had the sophists, even back then you had the sophists in the days of the Stoics, who essentially their entire craft was arguing divorced from reality.
Right.
You know, I will try to make any argument a sound argument or an attractive argument. The Stoics believed that the first and the primary goal of philosophy was to be an applicable discipline.
Yes. Right.
And so, of course, Auguste Comte has take a shot, because I think this is a very good, this is a very appropriate description. Auguste Comte's philosophy would create what John Galton, Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged, described as an orgy of self-sacrifice.
Now, isn't Auguste Comte's version of altruism exactly what Ayn Rand was arguing against when she came up with the concept of rational, big all caps rational, selfishness, lower caps?
Yes. Rand was not against things such as kindness and generosity. She was against people forcing that on you by the force of the government. You know, she believed that kindness and generosity and things of that sort need to be voluntary. But she mainly argued against those notions of altruism that were couched in Auguste Comte's ideas. You know, in one of her letters, she talks about how she met this girl, I wish I could remember who it was, but she was this girl who wanted to be an artist. She wanted to go to art school and study, and she got rallied by her family, railed by her family. They railed against her, saying, how could you be so selfish? You should be going to Africa and, you know, working to help the poor. You wanting to become an artist in this day and age, that's just selfish and indulgent. And, to a lot of people that sounds crazy, but there are people who think like this, who feel, because it's a very, very emotional argument to appeal. It's like, you know, and it's always kind of funny too, because you'll notice that it's people always tell other people, why don't you do this? But yeah. you don't see them doing that themselves.
Right. Right. And that's exactly it. Right. I mean, you don't see the people arguing that the Canadian government should give up, you know, they're complaining about 1.9 million doses, I believe. 1.9 million out of 30 million doses. Mm-hmm. I don't see people like, you know, Stephen Lewis, who brought this topic. Yeah, the complaint. I don't see him giving up his quality of life overall to give all his money to HIV AIDS in Africa, right? He's going in as a US special envoy. So he goes in and it's like an altruism vacation, right? He goes in, he stays there for a while. He comes back to his cushy life, you know, hobnobbing with Canada's elites. He's not giving up his lifestyle to, in, you know, Mother Teresa style. He's not living in poverty alongside the you know, starving people in Africa with HIV AIDS, which is a stereotype people in Africa really don't like. I've discovered.
And of course, the funny thing about the Mother Teresa comparison is that Mother Teresa was not the kindly old woman that people make her out to be.
That's what I found kind of, I think Hitchens went overboard with the emotional appeals in his criticisms of Mother Teresa, but I think he wasn't wrong in saying that as well-meaning as she was, she may have actually exacerbated poverty through her methods. Yes.
Well, you know, in her she believed, and this is also a thing that ties to altruism, that suffering ennobles you. And her aim really wasn't to create hospitals for people to heal. It was creating places for people to die. In order to kind of ennoble her own soul. And that's monstrous. I mean, he did call her the ghoul of Calcutta, and as hyperbolic as Hitchens could be, I think that was a very, very apt description of her. And I think the greatest con in this whole thing is that she has become kind of the poster girl for kindness, and it really is not.
I wish Hitchens, I mean, let's face it, the only reason we know the name Christopher Hitchens is because, ironically, of his appeals to emotion. However, I think there are times that appeals to emotion as a rhetorical device are appropriate, and I think that may have been one, even though I don't think he got as many converts as he otherwise would, ironically, by going overboard with the ghoulish metaphors. You know, he was being a contrarian. That's what he enjoyed doing. Only the privileged are allowed to be contrarians that way. but this is not off topic, guys, because this particular argument, this particular vaccine nationalism argument in Canada is literally an argument between two extremes. I'm not saying that the Trudeau government is functioning in extremes. A half and half policy is the exact opposite of what we could call extreme, right? But you've got Europe going, nope, we don't want to let any, okay, maybe we're going to choose to let this vaccine out, but we can shut it down at any time. Ours. They're what's his name? Larfleas from
the Great Lantern.
Mine, right? The seagulls in Finding Nemo. That Europe right now. Mine. So you got Europe on the one end, which we can all agree is
cuckoo nanners.
Well, is short-sighted, I will say, because again, if you can't be all the criticism Europe heaped on Trump of, if America can't be relied upon to honor its deals, then America cannot be relied upon. All that has to happen is America votes in one despot and everything's off the table. That was the argument that Europe scolded the US with for 4 years. And now they're showing that their word is not necessarily any good. Allowing their companies to keep contracts is optional. That's the one extreme. The other extreme is this, oh no, You can't even take a fraction of the vaccines you paid for your own people. The less fortunate should get it first. The problem with this thinking is, you know, a person in Canada who has lost a family member and couldn't even say goodbye to them because they're dying of an incredibly contagious disease, they don't feel terribly fortunate. This idea of we get to determine which lives matter more is a problem. The only way that a government cannot determine which lives matter more, the only way a government doesn't play God, is through this half and half approach that the Trudeau government did in the first place. Like, just logically, the only way you say no life is worth more than another life, which nobody really lives by, in fairness, but the only way you can say that on paper is say, okay, our people get half, everybody else gets half. That's totally equitable. Unfortunately, we're living in an age where equity isn't equality. And that's the bigger, I don't know if you followed this at all, Mouse, the sort of critical theory extension kind of, it's not even affirmative action. It's beyond that. It's that in order to, equality is not equity. Equality is everybody basically gets the same thing. Equity is, oh no, because of historical injustices, some people deserve more than others now to sort of as a top up. Are you familiar with this theory?
I have heard it mentioned. I have heard it spoken of, yes.
I mean, that's the underlying philosophy of this thought, that Canada should take nothing for itself out of the COVAX fund, even though that wasn't the original deal. It is immoral to vaccinate one's own citizens at the same rate as you vaccinate the rest of the world. The problem with the starving children in Africa version of equality versus equity, again, you're dealing with absolute poverty instead of relative poverty. And unfortunately, some of these proponents of starving children in Africa, people like Bono from U2, ignore the fact that these people are, you know, they are victims of their own governments in a great many ways, via flat out authoritarianism, or corruption, or, you know, any of this stuff. The Economist released its world democracy index this week as well, and Canada was one of the few countries that actually improved its democratic systems.
Oh, color me surprised.
Yeah, the world is slipping away from democracy. Now, part of that is because of COVID, and the lockdowns gave everybody a knock, but that tells you something about how much Canada has improved as a democratic nation, because we did lockdowns and our score still went up.
Yeah, and authoritarianism and populism are on the rise, unfortunately.
Yeah,
it's interesting because the discussion of equality and equity, yeah, in and of itself, it always seems to me that it's trying to correct a symptom but never the cause. Because, you know, through the argument of equity, you are essentially, yeah, you're shifting who gets the privilege, mm-hmm, right? But what does that look like 1, 2, 3 generations down the line? Will it magically equalize itself? No, because the problem is that the very self-same tribalist, collectivist ideas are still in play and are still being given credence by public and political discourse. The only way in which you can ever, ever solve in any significant way the problems of inequality, of racism, etc., sexism, is to essentially find a way to destroy that collectivist dialogue, that tribalist dialogue. And unfortunately, well,
the identity, identity politics driven, judging people as classes instead of individuals, right?
Yes, classes, yeah, and genders, all of that. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the discussion of equity does not transcend that problem. It merely uses the same framework,
right,
to try and reach a different solution. But you can't reach a different solution with that same framework, with the same structure.
Right.
You have to create new structures. You have to champion a different type of discourse. And it's a discourse that it's not as cuddly and it's not as reassuring, because then you basically have to aim to appeal to rational individualism.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, that means, you know, people having the liberty to say certain things, to do certain things,
within reason,
within reason, and that you might not be comfortable with. For example, it's perfectly fine for someone for whom I am, you know, auditioning for a job, for auditioning.
Why not? It's kind of what it is. It's a performance when you go into a job interview.
Yeah, except that most people don't have to pay for job interviews.
Good point. Yes.
And, you know, actually most performers don't have to pay for auditions, only in opera people.
Yeah.
You have to pay, you have to pay for the privilege of being interviewed, but it should be fine. It should be not fine, but the person whose job I am applying for, they should be able to tell me, by the way, I am prejudiced against gay people. So I can go, okay, fuck you. I'm going to work for someone else.
Right.
Because if they're not allowed to let me know that, that just means that they're going to find, and if they end up having to hire me because of, you know, HR policies, whatever, they're going to make my life in that company absolute hell. And I will never know why. I will start questioning myself, like, am I really not that good of a worker?
The gaslighting in those, I mean, every woman knows exactly what you're talking about, because you always know the, you know, middle managers who were hired under those affirmative action in the 80s things, because they are terrified of any woman with ambition, and they crush you because they think it's the freaking Highlander and there can only be one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's an issue. I mean, there's other elements, the job application thing. I wrote it down. I made a note, Mouse, because that ties back into our specific example that we're dealing with today. Mm-hmm. Because these speculative contracts that these vaccine manufacturers made with these various governments, they were essentially job applications, right? You are trusting us because, hey, Canada paid out a portion of the money, whether they got the vaccine or not. These vaccines were not approved, right? The governments trusted these companies to come through. They were funding their research. The idea that somebody takes a risk and gets absolutely nothing out of it in the end is absurd. Now, granted, the COVAX programs don't apply to Johnson & Johnson. They don't apply to Pfizer. They don't apply to Moderna. It's the AstraZeneca vaccine was developed with the Oxford University. So there were some public funds that went into it, but let's face it, Operation Warp Speed in the US was basically public funds as well, right? Yeah. Like taxpayers in the rich world funded the lightning fast development of these vaccines. If there is not a payoff for that, right? Who sits down and goes through all the pain of a job interview unless there's the possibility that you're going to get a job at the end, right? Sanity of overspending for these vaccines because they do, right? They're some of the money will never see the light of day because some vaccines will fail. That's what drug companies say all the time. These brand name prescription drugs are so expensive because you're paying for the 10 drugs that failed as well as the one that succeeded, right?
Right.
So this argument that poor countries are going to be left out of basically inflationary prices in medicine, I would argue this speculative buying in the research stage creates a backstop against that, because these vaccine doses are already paid for. The companies cannot jack up the price. The price has already been negotiated.
Yeah, it's been already agreed upon.
Right. So they're using a model that, yes, unfortunately, guys like PharmaBro did do on things like EpiPens, which are generic drug, not these fancy, you know, messenger RNA vaccines that are super proprietary and need to be kept on Hoth wrapped in Hoth cold temperatures. I just
had an image of Luke carrying the vials.
Yeah, well, they have to thaw the vials out in a dead tauntaun, right? Yeah. Now I'm just I think there's a certain amount of razzle dazzle with that. I think that method, all these freezers, these ultra cold freezers that people invested in, those are going to be fairly useless in probably 2 years as, you know, vaccine supplies improve. And this is one of the things the market does. Yes, the Pfizer vaccine is an expensive way to vaccinate people.
Anytime anyone mentions Pfizer, I cringe a little bit because my linguistic anal retentiveness wants me to call it Pfizer.
Pfizer. Well, okay, let's face it. They anglicized the name for a reason.
I know. Asher, right? Asher, every time I mention it, Asher turns to me and goes, "It's Pfizer in the United States." I'm like, okay.
That's like La Cienega Boulevard.
Or Buena Vista.
Do they say Buena Vista?
Yes.
I've only heard Buena Vista.
No. Here in Colorado, there's places called Buena Vista and they're called Buena Vista. And I'm like, oh God, kill me now.
Well, it's like Montpellier.
Yeah,
Montpellier. Well. There's Montpellier, Quebec, but it's Montpellier, Vermont. Mm-hmm. But what that actually got me, I went La Cienega instead of La Cienega. Mm-hmm. But Peabody, Massachusetts. It's a suburb of Boston. Peabody, like Sherman and Peabody. This is when I realized that some parts of America only have one vowel.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. Two vowels. There's the short I and the short A. That's all they have. That's it. And Peabody, you know, P-E-A-B-O-D-Y is Peabody.
Peabody.
Peabody. Peabody, biddy, biddy, biddy. That's all, folks. That's how I had to remember it, because they laugh at you if you said Peabody.
Peabody.
And they knew you weren't from around there. And of course, the area gets a huge amount of tourism because that's where Salem is.
Right.
That's how I know this. I was subjected to Peabody so I could go play Harry Potter in Salem back when that was cool and not embarrassing.
Right? Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, there's all these emotional trappings. This isn't just a tangent, even though it was a very funny tangent.
For the Harry Potter episode, look up the J.K. Rowling one and you'll see what
you'll know why I'm saying that's not cool anymore. But things like Pfizer anglicizing its name when, why are all these slowdowns happening because of a factory in Germany?
Yeah.
You know, because it's not actually pronounced Pfizer. It's Frankenstein, you know.
It's Frankenstein.
Frankenstein. That's a young Frankenstein reference. Yes. Highly recommend that movie because
there we go. I have a story. Can I tell the story?
Yes, you can tell the story.
So I was in college in North Carolina. Lovely, lovely area, Asheville, North Carolina, Swannanoa Valley. It was also a very, very hippie type of college. And those of you familiar with the area know of the hippie college. And yes, that's the one. And I had a neighbor who I almost said his name. I'm not going to say his name, but it was a really cool name. Actually, I went, "Is that really your name?" And he went, "Yeah." And I was like, "Oh, wow, that's cool." Anyways, he was really cute. And he had a tendency to bring his girlfriend over a lot. His room was next to mine and the walls were super thin.
Oh, no.
And so I ended up having a slew of very, very poorly slept nights, because he would bring his girlfriend over and over and over and over, and she would be coming over and over and over. And it was loud. You could hear it from the hallway. And so at one point I just got so fed up. I left the room And all you could hear through the door, ah, ah, ah. So I put my mouth against the crack of the door and I wait for the this crescendo to reach its most significant point. And I just blast, oh, sweet mystery of life, at last I found you. Silence.
And you harmonied it instead of melodied it too.
Yes. Absolute silence. And then a very, very quiet shit. And that was the last I ever heard of his girlfriend.
They honestly did not know they were that loud.
They honestly did not know.
Well, that's kind of an example of sex makes you stupid.
Yeah.
Like, holy cow. I assume that he could hear you moving around in your, because I know how thin those sorts of walls are. It's sort of like the college dorm problem.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So speaking of kind of, what do you even call that? That's not even cognitive dissonance. That's just a complete obliviousness to the fact that sound travels both ways.
Oh gosh. No, I had a terrible, terrible cognitive dissonance.
Yeah. Oh, I see what you did there. I'm still trying to figure out which version of the word to come you meant when you said his girlfriend was coming over and over and over again. I assume it means both, but
actually, that was completely unintentional. Now that you pointed out, I know there's someone who's listening to this podcast. Hi, Kian, who is going to go. That was not intentional.
Oh, sweet mystery of life. At last I found you.
No, the usage of the
yes. I figured that was unintentional. That was not your style. So okay, I want to bring up another thing. This is a really amazing segue. You're going to be so impressed with me, where people do not realize that a concept goes both ways. Okay, because pop quiz, not to put you on the spot. What's the big tool that the United Nations uses to prevent outright violent hot wars right now? Economic sanctions, right?
Mm-hmm.
So governments that behave badly get sanctioned from trade and other things that mm-hmm. The argument is they put pressure on the government through the suffering of their own citizens, right? That's how sanctions work. People right. become poorer and poorer and poorer. Eventually the government loses favor. There's a reason these don't necessarily work, because authoritarians don't give a shit how much their people suffer. But they've been applying sanctions on Iran and North Korea and places like that for years, and they insist they're working. Maybe they're right. That's not the point of this segue. The point is, they argue that economic repercussions, economic penalties on poorly run governments are just. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
They're arguing the exact opposite with this vaccine nationalism thing, that we need to backstop governments that can't take care of their own people. You can't have it both ways. Either vaccine nationalism argues that sanctions are immoral, or sanctions prove this extreme vaccine nationalism argument is bullshit. The greatest thing that has contributed to peace in the modern age is international trade.
Mm-hmm.
Right? If we're stepping away from things like tied aid, because that's not the laundry detergent, the idea that aid comes with certain strings. So it's not actually aid. It's a business transaction with, you know,
a quid pro quo.
Yeah, not even. They don't really benefit the nation that's getting the aid. It never actually quite works out. It's like workfare. Nice idea, but, you know, why are you calling it a form of welfare if the person is working for the money? it's not workfare at all. It's subsidized labor at that point, you know? Mm-hmm. But you can't have it both ways. You can't cheer sanctions as a alternative to warfare, saying, oh no, it's totally fair that we punish, say, Iran for its hostilities, and then say, oh no, but we apply a completely different standard to other poorly run nations. Why? We're not necessarily going to think about that, right? Sorry, because?
Because.
Yeah, because Saudi Arabia is our ally. Like, why Saudi Arabia needs financial help?
I know.
Holy of all the places, Saudi Arabia's on this freaking list, okay? I don't know if they're a giver state, or it just says of the potentially self-financing countries that expressed written interest in the COVAX facility. Saudi Arabia's on that list. But I mean, it's not clear whether, you know, Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, the Czech Republic, Estonia is not rich enough to buy vaccines for other people.
Yeah.
So it's like, who's getting, here we are, low income. Okay, so Afghanistan, we're supposed to give vaccines to the Taliban? What? Benin, Burkina Faso, Burundi, Central African Republic, Chad, the Congo. Oh yeah, because they're going to give vaccines to people in the Congo.
Oh, yeah.
Right, Eritrea, Ethiopia, okay. Gambia, the Guinea-Bissau, Haiti. Haiti's got problems right now. Mm-hmm. They got Korea, Democratic People's Republic. Okay, so that's North Korea. They're actually going to send vaccines to North Korea? Okay. Liberia, Madagascar, Malawi. Okay. Mali, Mozambique, Nepal, Niger, Rwanda, Sierra Leone, Somalia, South Sudan, Syrian African Republic, Tanzania, Tajikistan.
The Carmen San Diego tune in my background right now as you're reading these.
Yeah. Yemen? How the hell are we going to get vaccines to anybody in Yemen?
Mm-hmm.
How's that going to work? Great, great idea. You're asking people to risk their own lives to go into a failed state war zone.
Yeah.
And then, of course, you know, India is listed as a lower middle income country. India's problem is not GDP. India's problem is income inequality, right? India is one of those roaring economies right now. And, you know, this is the problem with the narrative surrounding places like India. They'll go, oh, look, it's improving so much. And yet, you know, people are outsourcing it. Right. For whom? Yes, there is a growing middle class in India. But, you know, India is clearly not there yet. Stop talking like it is. There's a reason it's a source of cheap labor. Right.
Yeah. You've got all the issues with the caste system to begin with.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so people like Stephen Lewis want Canada to throw away money trying to get vaccines into Afghanistan, where the Taliban is getting ready for war again because Trump's no longer in charge. And Yemen, okay, they want to send vaccines there despite all the other problems, right? Myanmar is on the lower middle income. There was just a military coup.
Yeah.
Like, why are you sanctioning Iran? Why are you sanctioning, I refuse to call it the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, okay? It's North Korea. There's nothing democratic about it. And there's nothing about the people in North Korea. So you're sanctioning North Korea on one hand, and then you're sending vaccines to North Korea. What? You know, like Kim Jong-un,
mm-hmm,
is not going to vaccinate people who are loyal to him first. Like, it isn't going to increase the inequality in North Korea. I mean, granted, okay, they'll get it somehow. The argument probably there is that if we don't give it to them, China will. And at this point, okay, let China give it to them. Like, yeah. Why are we spending money on North Korea? I get certain things, right? I totally get relief in Haiti. once the situation calms down a little bit, you know, like think places like Samoa. Yeah, we kind of owe Samoa, right? We kind of screwed up places like Samoa and Papua New Guinea, right? Yeah. Even the Ukraine has had a bad time of it. I have no problem sending vaccines to Ukraine, right? Vietnam, absolutely no problem sending vaccines to Vietnam. Some of these make sense, right? But this is the problem. Why are we treating a place like Vietnam or a place like Cambodia or a place like Ukraine on the same plane as North Korea and Yemen?
Korea.
Like, okay, the Yemenis people, they're caught, right? They're screwed. Afghanistan, same thing. But let's face it, it is going to be extremely difficult, and there are likely going to be losses of both life and product getting vaccine into those places. Yeah. Why don't we start with places that have better outcomes? This whole idea is just all emotional reasoning. And no, look, there are benefits to being a good citizen of the world. You know, there's, you're not going to buy any goodwill in these countries. I understand countries that are, they haven't gone over yet, right? I understand the argument of we have to do business with them so they don't turn to Russia and China. I understand that in places like Africa, though it's probably a little too late.
A little too late, I think, honestly, at this point. Yeah,
well, because too many governments didn't do that before this. And so China got in there and started paying Africa to dump their toxic waste. True story, look it up. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I understand that in theory, but that does not apply to places like, you know, Yemen, that's the site of a proxy war, and North Korea. This is just nothing about this COVAX program as it currently exists is logical. They are benefiting. And I guarantee you some of these countries are there as a sop to places like Saudi Arabia, right? Mm-hmm. I guarantee you that's why Yemen's there. And maybe South Korea wants North Korea vaccinated because there's some spread, though there's not a lot of cross-border travel between those two countries.
Yeah.
Right. Maybe they're afraid of some espionage going in there, and I don't know. But this doesn't make sense. This is, think of the starving children in Africa. The starving children in Africa and other places too, right? Instead of recognizing, look, let's vaccinate the people where we can get the most benefit first, right? Not a place where someone's more likely right now to die of malaria than COVID, you know, more likely to die of starvation or violence, or, you know, a place that just had a military coup. You know, let's have some benefits to good behavior so that countries want to stay citizens of the world instead of this stupid false strength spiral of everyone just flexing their muscles to make the most noise because that's how you get attention from the UN.
Uh-huh.
Right? Like, have you noticed how many authoritarian regimes are now claiming election fraud to hold power now that America has been all about election fraud and 75% of Republicans believe the election was stolen? This is what happens. You know, this is what happens when the richest countries in the world behave like idiots collectively. Apologies to Mouse, apologies to you and your fellow Americans. I was referring to your past government, not all the people. Well, and certain news outlets that brainwashed a massive portion of the population. Yeah, exactly.
As I sip my coffee so I don't go into a diatribe.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I'm on a bit of a diatribe here, I admit. Like, what strikes me about this whole Stephen Lewis, it isn't moral to take the doses that you paid for because you paid for those doses, so an equal number of doses can go everywhere else. Like, it's morally wrong to take what you paid for. I argue And Mouse, maybe I'm overreaching here. I argue that it's morally wrong not to take the doses. Because hear me out. If you follow the terms of the original deal, that is a fair trade. That is a good, that we agreed to it, signed, sealed, and delivered, promise made, promise kept, to use the platitude. Okay, this is business, right? We see the benefit to this global program. If all of a sudden it just becomes an exercise in ruinous altruism, all of a sudden it's sending the message to these other countries, oh no, we look down on you. We think you're pathetic. It's really robbing people of their dignity to change the deal halfway. You know
and
what
it's
I'm
also
saying?
And it's also sending the message, this is how you can manipulate us.
Oh, that's an interesting argument too. That it's
because
right.
You have people who have, you know, genuine need, right? And you also have people who are cognizant of people that are compassionate, who look out for people in need, and they manipulate them.
That's a really good point.
And often misrepresent their own situation so that they can, you know, get a windfall or munificence from people. So it's not, and countries do this too.
Well, I mean, in parts of the world where you know, bartering, like negotiation is, you don't go into a store and just pay the price. You actually have to, you know, what do they call it? Shoot. Is it bartering? No. Haggling. That's haggling. The word I'm looking for. That's part of it. So, I mean, parts of the world where haggling is the norm, they're like, what are you doing? There was a deal and now you're paying more? That's stupid. I'll take it. But what's wrong with you? You're not speaking a language these countries understand, right? This isn't building respect. This isn't, you know, this is a handout, not a hand up model. And that doesn't help anyone in the long term, right? Like, how does this help India's farmers? It doesn't. Because, well, India looks like they're paying into the... No, God, this is so unclear. This list of countries.
Oh, no, I was looking at it last night and I gave up.
Well, India's listed as a lower middle income country, but they're also a signatory. But the point is, do you think Modi's really going to distribute this vaccine to the farmers that are trying to overthrow the government? Or, no, they're not. They're just protesting. That was a mistake. They're not trying to overthrow the government. They're protesting a law that's coming in. But do you think he's actually going to give the vaccine to the farmers? No. He's going to give the vaccine to his loyalists, when in fact, the farmers are the ones that actually need it because they're essential workers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the thing is, this idea about vaccine equity. The problem with it is it stops at the border of a lot of these countries. So what you're, okay, yes, you're distributing the vaccine equitably around the world in some kind of macro format. But that equity isn't going to reach the world's neediest people. It gets concentrated among the haves in those countries. That don't have solid democracy, that don't have all that stuff, you know?
It's going to go to the people who have the politics of pull.
Right. It's cronies and loyalists for those local governments.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as, and this is the exact same mistakes that people made with Africa for a really long time, the idea that charity was going to solve the problem there. And what they actually found is microloans to women in those countries did astoundingly better than widespread aid programs. We're talking like $150 to buy a goat. Okay, we're talking about that little money. Why women? They turned out that they were better financial risks. They actually were going to see a return on investment, in part because they were less likely to die in some violent conflict. Mm-hmm. But yeah, buying women livestock so they could start providing for themselves.
Like, and you know, that's an initiative by entities such as the Heifer Project International.
Mm-hmm.
I actually went to one of their I went to their camp with my class freshman year. We did their whole global village thing. Learned about the Heifer Project and volunteered. It's a pretty cool charitable program.
So you know how effective these programs are.
Yeah, they're much more effective than the international aid donations from governments.
Well, I mean, all the tied aid of the 80s has had to been forgiven, right? Mm-hmm. Like, because it didn't work.
Exactly.
More and more and more money that strangely disappears. The one I'm familiar with is Kiva.
Yeah.
The Kiva program. It's the exact same thing.
It's almost as if empowering individuals to create a thriving market is a lot more effective than centralized planning and government just throwing money at a problem.
I mean, just simply the sense of dignity that Sherrod Brown goes on. Like, we talk about the dignity of work for the middle class, but for some odd reason that goes out the window when we start talking about the poor.
Yeah.
You know, there's a mentality to poverty that I think is actually more pervasive and more damaging the long term than the actual lack of money. They don't have the financial skills. I know this because I guess we've both experienced upward mobility in our lives. People with more money handle money differently.
Yeah. I was for close to a decade, I was on a student visa and I couldn't work outside of campus.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, the money that they pay you on campus is
shit.
Peanuts.
Yeah, it's
shit. Peanuts.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have complained as much if I had like the job I wanted to be like work at the library because it's interesting.
Right.
But no, the only jobs that are ever available are the ones at the cafeteria. And I don't mind the cafeteria as much, except for the problem of that it has on my skin.
Right.
Anyone who has ever worked at cafeteria.
Yeah.
And always get stuck with the dish cleaning, which means you are manipulating scalding hot water. Mm-hmm. And you get perma dry hands for years after that.
Well, also the fry bins, you're getting oil, grease, dirt on your skin. It's terrible for your skin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but you know, for a decade, because you know, it's people would tell me, oh no, you should just work illegally off campus, you know, just become illegal. And I was like,
so you get crazy? Deported. Great. Yeah.
So I could get deported. You know, back then it was the Obama administration and people assumed that President Obama was immigrant friendly. He wasn't.
No.
As
well,
hostile,
he was, but his policies weren't.
But yeah, his policies, yeah. He deported more people than George Bush did. And so I'm going in for my citizenship now fairly soon. And my immigration lawyer says, you know, your case is one of the easiest ones I have to deal with because your record is absolutely spotless.
You did nothing wrong.
I did nothing wrong because, you know, Asher and I were like, no, we're not taking any risks because, yeah, whatever, you've got this president here, but you never know who's going to be in the future, said my prophetic soul.
Yes. Yeah. No, but you are so careful.
But for all of those years, where basically I had to rely on my partner's income and what little I could bring in working legally on campus, it was, you know, I did feel that kind of lack of dignity because mm-hmm. I wasn't really working. I wasn't really part of a workforce.
Right.
I was working on campus on jobs that weren't, you know, they were even paying you below what you would make at a McDonald's.
Right.
And you know, if I worked at a McDonald's, I could at least have access to their shake machine when it wasn't broken.
McDonald's shakes disgust me. I can't. I can't. There's so little dairy. The fact that I can drink a McDonald's milkshake, even though I can't have milk and it doesn't bother my stomach, I think I should not be putting this in my body. I'm just, apologies to McDonald's. It's just my personal thing. But when you don't get the effect that a food should give you, it's not real food.
I know. But so once And the thing that was keeping me, people are going to ask, so, you know, why didn't you get married? Because I was in a committed relationship.
Funny that.
And I got asked that question a lot, you know, why doesn't your husband marry you and sponsor you for immigration? Well, and here's the thing. In the United States, you only have two viable ways to immigrate. One is if a company sponsors you, which is a gigantic rigmarole in and of itself at the cost of the company. Mm-hmm. So you know, usually you only get people in disciplines, in STEM disciplines, getting sponsored by tech companies or medical companies or whatever. Right. So that was out of the picture.
And of course, and the other thing, Eastern European women working at Trump hotels.
And that was definitely a thing. And the other one was through marriage.
Right.
You know, if you are in a relationship and you get married, then of course your spouse can sponsor you for a green card and eventual citizenship, unless you happen to be gay. Mm-hmm. Because the Defense of Marriage Act, which was signed under the Clinton administration, defined marriage at the federal level between, solely between a man and a woman. And immigration as a federal, not state, affair.
Yes.
Didn't give two shits about which states had what would they call it at that point? Civil unions.
Yeah.
They didn't give a shit because that had absolutely nothing to do with immigration. So basically my husband and I were on a holding pattern. Mm-hmm. Basically we were going, well, at one point this is going to get overturned. Maybe. If not, mm-hmm. we're going to have to move to another country. But for the time being, you know, he worked and I just did my thing at college. Got my degrees, and then eventually DOMA got overturned. We had been together at that point, I think 13 years. Mm-hmm. And we got married in between rehearsals for one of the operas, because at that point I was doing my master's in vocal performance, and I was the star, basically. My name was in the opera. My character's name was the name of the opera. So that's, you know, that means you're the leading role. Yeah. I was starring in Idomeneo. In between rehearsals, we got married, and then we started the process. And then in 2015, I got my green card, and I was able to work. And of course, technically speaking, financially, I am behind by at least 13 years. A lot of people got their start to be able to actually save and whatnot before I did, but. Right. It is an enormous difference between being powerless, because it was, you know, the government telling you, no, you can't work, you can't work, you can't work, you can't make money.
Yeah.
Not being able to make money for 13 years. Just imagine that.
And this is not a tangent, guys. This is an example of what happens when emotionally driven policies are created to soothe irrational passions, as opposed to going, okay, long term, if a life is really worth the same as any other life, don't we owe the people we are giving, you know, our benevolence to the right to dignity, instead of setting them up for a decades long loop of gradually having their humanity and their equal status stripped from them through shitty systems. I mean, U.S. immigration law should be a cautionary tale. It really is. Because they have created so many problems that here's my prediction. And keep this in mind when you talk about issues like vaccine nationalism that seem very silly and sort of, you know, thought exercises instead of, because I don't think the Trudeau government's going to blink. But here's what's going to happen with U.S. immigration. The Dreamers are going to start having children. And there is just going to be a population boom of voting blocks that will hate the Republican Party forever if the Republican Party still exists. Mm-hmm. And at that point, it's gonna solve itself, because the more, Arizona went purple, Texas is on its way. There's a reason for this. The Dreamers are gonna have kids. Those kids are full-blown American citizens, and those kids are gonna be pissed because of what happened to their parents. And when something is done to you, you can forgive, you can rationalize it. When you are raised in stuff that's being done to your parents, you never forget that.
Nope.
And if these programs, and this is the thing people don't realize about the benevolence of the first world, it doesn't filter down to regular people in places like, you know, North Korea, because the propaganda machine says, oh no, we gave you this, the West is evil, right? If we don't have a system where governments are responsible for their own people, then we have a system of unaccountable governments. The same way, apparently nobody's responsible for these Dreamer kids. You know, nobody's responsible for immigrants in America. It's just, you're on your own. The person who's responsible is the people who sponsor them in, right? You're creating dependence, which, as you said, has a bad impact on you psychologically.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you look at it, I mean, if you want to look at the abstraction and how it applies to just about so much in America,
yeah,
you know, you can say enterprises are not responsible for themselves, right, if they get bailed out.
That's
from
right.
Decisions.
Right. And there's a big difference between something you're just given and something you earn.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, COVAX sponsor countries go back on their pre-existing deals, it is the difference between something you're just given because, oh, you pitiable thing, right? Versus a deal's a deal. Like, this is what we agreed to. Part of this is, you know, just there is a greater good principle, but let's be reasonable here. Like, it's a completely different paradigm of one for me, one for you, one for me, one for you. And I'm going to give you everything because our people aren't sitting here, you know, potentially losing their houses, mortgage payments backing up. Like, it is so ridiculous that they would ask any government to do that to their own people. That's not saying lives around the world are worth the same as Canadian lives. That's saying lives around the world are worth more than Canadian lives. And there's no way around that. Like, COVID doesn't discriminate. That, yes, general health helps, but COVID doesn't discriminate. You get COVID, you're at risk, period, end of story. So for God's sakes. Okay, end rant. Should we wrap now, Mouse?
I think it's a good... No, I'm here.
Yes, he's
here. I forgot I had muted myself.
Oh, okay.
There's a little noise in the background, so I wanted to filter it out as much as possible.
Okay, we're both getting punchy, so I think it is a good time to wrap. This has been the Broken Clock Podcast on the FU Network. FUnetwork.tv, PayPal, Patreon. We really appreciate your support. It is not charity. You are signing up to allow us to continue to work for you and bring you this stimulating content with singing and funnies. And, as usual, Mouse's final word.
From Lucius Seneca, no man was ever wise by chance.